After days of waiting, Dorian finally passes by the First Coast. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And this hour, we'll update you on Dorian's impact here in Northeast Florida. It's 549-2937 to join us. And the First Coast is thankfully getting back to business today. Hurricane Dorian only delivered something of a glancing blow to this area. It's moving up the coast now, heading toward the Carolinas. Here in this neck of the woods, Duval County schools will reopen tomorrow, and most city agencies and businesses are also up and running today. Some areas did experience storm surge, down trees, and flooding, however. At the height of the storm, there were also thousands of power outages across the region. The push is on today to restore power as fast as possible. Most people do have power restored, but we've got an update right now as we welcome Carrie Stewart, Senior VP and Chief Customer Officer at JEA. Carrie, good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us, particularly after working round the clock during the storm. Already getting calls for Carrie Stewart of JEA. You can call us up right now to connect with the utility. The number is 549-2937. Give us a call. 549-2937. Did you make it through the storm okay? We want to hear from you. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is also open. All right. Some relief across the region, right, Carrie? I'm sure at JEA as well. Wasn't too bad. Can you bring us up to date? What's the situation right now when it comes to power outages across the region?
So I won't speak for the whole region, but certainly our service territory is 900 square miles through four different counties. And so as I sit here today, coming in moments ago, we have 62 customers that are out of power right now. And that is likely due to normal outages. I think we were joking earlier, it might have been a squirrel or a car accident. So the normal outages that we deal with.
So, yeah, that's thankfully a low number. What was it like for JEA at the height of the storm, and how many outages have we experienced overall throughout the last week?
So there are a little over 32,000 customers without power through the course of the week. That's a cumulative number. It has been attributed to the height of the storm, but that is a cumulative number. Mm-hmm. On any given outage, we never had more than 3,000 customers out of power at any one time during the whole course of the storm.
And that speaks to the well-oiled machine, I guess, that JEA has developed over the years in responding to these severe weather events. Can you share a little bit about how that goes into action?
Sure. Well, certainly since Irma, we learned a lot of lessons, and we have poured millions of dollars into the infrastructure on the water and wastewater side, as well as to some resiliency efforts, tree trimming, lots of things that we do on the energy side as well. We also were very fortunate that the winds never reached a level that we had to pull our crews in from out in the field. So we're able to respond during the storm the entire time. The winds never reached a sustained level that would keep our crews sheltered or out of the bucket trucks.
That's good to hear. It's 549-2937 as we speak with Carrie Stewart of JEA. So after each major weather event, we learned something. What were the lessons learned from Matthew and also Hurricane Irma that you put into practice this time around with Dorian, would you say?
Would say a lot of it was investment into the infrastructure, hardening of our lift stations. We have over 1,400 lift stations. We were talking earlier before the show. That's more than any other utility in the United States, and that's how we move water and wastewater. We're a flat community. Mm-hmm. And so we have either hardwired backup generation or we have portable backup generation. So that reduces sanitary sewer overflows. It allows us to keep water and wastewater moving throughout our community, even at the height of a storm.
That's interesting because, of course, the main thing folks are caring about right now is their electricity. But this speaks to the many moving parts at JEA. And I didn't realize that till you told me that you have the largest water operation or wastewater operation in the U.S.
Yes, in terms of assets.
In terms of what you're controlling, assets you're controlling.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so other lessons that we learned from Matthew and from Irma were on the communication side, how we communicate with our customers during a storm, after a storm, getting all of our systems into play. So while Dorian didn't hit us square in the nose this time, we were able to exercise a lot of the technology upgrades that we have implemented since Irma and watch them in real time without the crush of, you know, several hundred thousand people out of power.
Right. That is a nightmare scenario, which you prepared for. Can you share a little bit about what the utility does to go round the clock? You have people sleeping on cots and on mattresses in the JEA tower. Is that right?
We're in the customer center. The tower is not safe during certain hurricane conditions and is not hurricane rated.
So you go to that adjoining building?
Yes. Okay. We go to the customer center, and we do. We sleep in offices. We sleep on the floor. We sleep on couches and on cots. We run 12-hour shifts. The emergency operations center runs 24/7. And the call center also runs 24/7. And so all of those stations are manned. And again, the crews are deployed when it is safe to be out and about. And again, they run 24-hour shifts as well.
Let us know if you lost power during the storm, how you fared during Hurricane Dorian. It's 549-2937 to join us. Okay, so let me ask about this. We've seen on social media the image of all of these trucks convoying up the spine of Florida and up toward the path of Dorian. It's headed toward the Carolinas. Will you be seeing some of your servicemen and women, some of your equipment, heading north to respond to problems that could potentially affect Georgia and the Carolinas? And how do the utilities work together in that type of situation?
Well, we have a vast mutual aid network, and that is between the investor-owned utilities, the public utilities, the municipally-owned utilities. And so, as you probably may have heard and your listeners may have heard, we had crews coming in from Texas who were hunkering down with us. They came in from Austin, and they came in from San Antonio. They came in from CPS and Austin Energy. So they will be pulling out today. They have not been contracted yet to work with any other crews up the East Coast. And we have been in constant communication with other utilities like Santee Cooper up in the Carolinas, Duke. We've been on calls with them the entire week just to make sure that they have what they need. Mm-hmm. But until this morning, when we know we for sure had the all clear, we didn't release any of our crews. And right now we're not planning to go anywhere, but we stand ready if the call comes.
Yeah. It's 549-2937. Are you getting back to work? School? School's actually out today still across Duval County, but we want to hear from you, as thankfully Hurricane Dorian was not too bad for this region. It's 549-2937. As we're learning from Carrie Stewart, some power disruptions across the listening area, but nothing like what we experienced a couple of years ago during Hurricane Irma. No major water issues either. And you're the chief customer officer for JEA, so your role is to really be as responsive as possible to the customers. And I think JEA is getting high marks on that front in the wake of this storm. Let me ask you on another note, as we're hearing more about, and you were here just a couple of weeks ago talking about this, about the move to potentially privatize this utility. What's your response to customers out there who are worried that if, say, Florida Power and Light came in and became the major utility for this area, that they wouldn't be as close to the community or as responsive to restoring power and communicating with customers in the aftermath of a big storm?
Well, I would respond to that by saying that JEA has been this community's utility for over 125 years. And we're going to continue to have employees that are here in Jacksonville. That is one of the criteria of the intent to negotiate. So any respondents to that ITN, as it's being called, would have to meet certain criteria, like having a headquarters in downtown Jacksonville and preparing and protecting the employees that are here. These are employees, 2,000 of them, that live, work, and play in this community, and they aren't going anywhere. So that's how I would respond.
Wouldn't there be layoffs, though, if the utility were sold to a private entity? That's another concern that I know has been raised. There would be fewer employees.
Well, right now, the answer is no. There would not be. And again, if you were to take a look at the intent to negotiate, there is protection for the employees that work at JEA for a minimum of 3 years. And so regardless of what is being said out in the community, the ITN is very clear and explicit that JEA employees would be protected.
Okay. But it's certainly an interesting time for the utility. You're dealing with major storms. You're dealing with the whole swirl of controversy around the ITN, as you described it. This is an intense time, I would think, at your company. And so when you get reaction from the community about all of these issues, what's the tone of it? How do you deal with that as chief customer officer?
Well, a lot of it is working with our employees and making sure that the community is getting the right messaging at the right time. Again, I was on here just a few weeks ago,
right,
talking to your listeners and letting them know that there's a lot of information about what is going on at JEA with our strategic planning. It's not just about this intent to negotiate. We are looking at the future of JEA, and we want to have our customers' input. We want our customers to pay attention. And we want them to come out to the website. They want to interact with us. As we move forward with our strategic planning, we will be getting out into the community more, hopefully coming back on your show again to talk to our customers about what their concerns are, what their fears are, and to ensure them that we are going to be here. JEA has been this community's utility for 125 years, and we are still going to be here regardless of what happens.
Right. And when you hear from activist groups in particular, I've seen the hashtag on social media, JEA is ours, for example, demanding that the utility remain in the public's hands. I know that could potentially put you in a difficult position because you're trying to be responsive to the customers, but also dealing with the board and the senior leadership of which you're a part. And the controversy around this has certainly raged for some time. Let me ask you too. You mentioned you weren't in the JEA tower during the storm. You were in the customer center. What's the latest on the move to relocate to a new headquarters in downtown for JEA? Some customers and advocates have raised red flags about that. Why move to an expensive new headquarters in the midst of potentially also selling to a private entity? Why invest in all of that?
Well, quite simply, because we are committed to Jacksonville. We're committed to downtown Jacksonville. And the building, the new building, we have the ability to back out of that contract if we decide not to move forward with certain parts of our strategic planning. But as it stands right now, our partners, the Ryan Companies, are moving forward, going to the Downtown Design Review Board, going to the DIA. We'll be going through City Council to get the building built. Mm-hmm. Our current state at the JEA building and the customer center, so you have the tower and the customer center, it is financially more expensive for us to remain where we are. The buildings are too big for the number of employees that we have and the customers that we serve. And it needs a lot of maintenance. It's a lot of upkeep. So the decision to move out of the building was made several years ago by the board, and they were looking at all of the financial numbers. It's very expensive to stay in our building and to continue to maintain it.
How old is the building?
You know,
mid-century, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so maybe 50, 60 years old,
yes.
Something like that. State of the art in its day. But
state of the art in its day.
Yeah. And I've had the opportunity to check out the space at the top of the building, which used to be a revolving restaurant.
Yes.
But is now used, I assume, mainly for company meetings and events and things like that.
Our board meets.
And the board meets there.
Our board meets there. It was all boarded up the last couple of days because it is all glass. And so that's the only thing. We use it for other company meetings as well, but mostly just board meetings.
And we're speaking with Carrie Stewart of JEA. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. People are still getting into their normal routines. I'm astounded you're not getting calls because normally anything involving JEA would generate a ton of calls. Okay, so you mentioned you're going to be getting out into the community and talking about JEA's future. Can you share a little bit more about that? And I know it's a big area, and it can be tough to get out and communicate to so many customers across this huge swath of people you serve. But what's the strategy to kind of get out and interact more with customers over the next months to communicate the messages you're here today to share?
Well, a lot of it starts with our earned, paid, and owned media channels, coming on shows like yours, talking about it on in other media platforms, our social media. Once we get out of the hurricane cone of whatever that is they call it, we will be moving our media messaging to engage our customers, to get our customers to pay attention to what's going on. We really want their feedback. We want them to understand what's going on. And so you'll start to see a lot of those communications proactively coming out. So we'll move from Restoration 123 and hurricane preparedness into strategic planning and what the future looks like at JEA. And letting our customers know that we're here for them and we're going to continue to be here for them. And we want them to be a part of what JEA looks like the next 125 years.
Let's go to some calls now for our JEA's Carrie Stewart. It's 549-2937. And let us know how you're getting back up to speed after, thankfully, Hurricane Dorian let us off easy over the last several days. John is on the south side. Hi, John. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for covering this topic. I have a question strictly out of curiosity. In past storms, I've seen lots of utility workers from different parts of the country come in to help with storm repairs. And I've always just wondered, in a situation like that, does JEA have to pay the salaries and travel expenses of those utility crews coming in from around the country? Or with this mutual aid network you mentioned earlier, does each utility just absorb its own salary and travel costs in terms of helping each other? It's just a question of curiosity.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, John.
Yeah. Thank you for the question, John. We actually pay the utilities. They will invoice us for the cost of their crews that come to support us. So there's a fully loaded cost. So it's the cost of the salary. It's the cost of the travel. We pay for hotel and lodging and food on site. So that's taken care of for all of the crews once they get here. For instance, in this storm, all of the crews and their trucks were parked at Morocco Shrine Temple over on the south side of Jacksonville.
That's a central location,
It's a perfectly central location. And we put them up in hotels. We make sure that they get fed three hot meals a day. And we take very good care of them while we're here. And then we work with the utilities that they come from and make sure that we cover the costs that for the crews that come over.
Interesting. Rusty on the west side. Hi, Rusty. Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Melissa. Thank you. And first of all, just big kudos to the line crews in the aftermath of Irma 2 years ago, because they really went all out. And I personally appreciate that back then. With regard to the current situation, it just appears that Mayor Curry and Mr. Zahn are partners in this venture. And furthermore, a bird has said that FPL is the buyer. And it's not much of a stretch that FPL said, hey, we got to have a new office tower. And, you know, eventually Mayor Curry said, well, you know, we've got capital funding. We can make that happen. And here we are. So that's all. And so I'd be interested in your guests.
Thanks for that. And this came up the last time you were here, Carrie. And obviously, this isn't your decision. You're there. You're in the utility to really respond to the needs of customers. But what about his point and the point that so many other listeners have raised with us, that they perceive that the mayor is working in concert with your CEO and other players to privatize this utility to pay off Jacksonville's debts against the wishes of the majority of the people out there?
Well, I would say everybody's job at JEA is to make sure that we take care of the customer. And that's really what the strategic planning effort is all about, is to make sure that we are a viable, safe, reliable, affordable utility for our customers in this region going forward. The customer is at the very center of the strategic planning. So I want to make that clear. The issues surrounding, and Rusty, I understand everything that you're saying. We hear it from the community. Our employees also hear those rumors. The CEO of FPL has actually said he's very interested in investing in JEA. What I will tell you is what I know, and that is this is not set for anyone to come in and buy JEA. certain terms have to be met by any interested party. And if those terms aren't met, and those terms are taking care of and protecting our employees, ensuring that our customers don't get rate increases, ensuring that we do have a downtown headquarters, ensuring that we do have continued investment in pure water, and that we have investment in solar energy and other renewable energy. So there's a minimum baseline of what our customers want and know and need, that we're going to ensure that JEA is that for all of our customers into the future.
Lisa in Bartram Park. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I was calling regarding the privatization. In Jacksonville, they privatized trash pickup, but yet we can't get our trash picked up on a regular basis. So we're not only customers, we're owners, and the priority should be to protect our utility, not to make money. But if you turn it into a private thing, the goal will be to make money. It won't be to protect the citizens of Jacksonville. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I think she sums up the sentiments that we've heard from so many folks out there. They're concerned that privatization would result in a decline in the high quality of customer service, which all the kudos to you and your staff. People currently like the level of customer service they get from a municipally owned utility.
Well, and I would respond to that by also saying, as a part of our strategic planning, before we move to this phase, which is a sort of a phase three in our strategic planning, phase two was a very bleak outlook for JEA. And what happens if we don't change, if we don't make some investments into JEA's future, into this community? Because what we do know will happen with the constant and unknown speed of technology disruption and other impacts to our business that come from public policy, that come from being a government entity, we're going to have to look at shrinking the utility, and that may mean customer service being eroded if we stay as we currently are. So that was a conversation that was had earlier in the year. Our board said that's not acceptable, and we don't want to shrink. We don't want to provide less customer service. Are there other alternatives out there? And that's what we're looking at now.
Well, we appreciate you bringing us up to date in the wake of the storm, and we hope you'll come back soon. Always good to connect with you and let listeners connect as well. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Carrie Stewart, she's Senior VP, Chief Customer Officer at JEA. As she told us earlier in the hour, just a few dozen folks still without power, and they are working to get everybody back up as soon as possible. Meanwhile, much more still ahead on the show, still to come.
Climate change is making hurricanes more intense, stronger, with larger winds.
Dorian Strength and the Role of a Changing Climate. We'll speak with climate scientist Michael Mann. That's next. We'll be right back.
Nova Southeastern University. There's more to getting an education than what textbooks can teach. NSU's industry-experienced professors impart real-world knowledge that helps fill in the blanks so you can succeed. Learn more at nova.edu/Jacksonville.
UF Health North on Max Leggett Parkway is the region's newest hospital and outpatient medical center, featuring all private rooms, 12 labor and delivery suites, full imaging, surgical services, and 24-hour emergency care. More at north.ufhealthjax.org.
High Tide Burrito Company, local since 2009, caters to hungry employees and bosses with fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food for lunch or parties. No more same old. Menu and ordering at hightideburrito.com.
Welcome back. Well, Hurricane Dorian's size and intensity is proof that climate change is driving more powerful and destructive storms. That is the consensus of climate scientists. WJCT's Brendan Rivers spoke about this phenomenon with climate scientist Michael Mann of Penn State University. Let's listen.
Great. And to start out, can you kind of generally speaking explain how climate change is impacting hurricanes?
Climate change is making hurricanes more intense, stronger, with larger winds, and with that, larger storm surges, which add to the effect of global sea level rise to give us far worse storm surges to represent quite a bit more coastal risk to our coastlines. At the same time, we know that a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, and so as sea surface temperatures warm up, there's more moisture in the atmosphere. That means these storms can produce larger amounts of flooding rains, of torrential rains. And we've seen that in recent years with storms like Hurricane Harvey when it made landfall in Houston, Texas, or Hurricane Florence last year when it made landfall in North Carolina. We are seeing larger, stronger, wetter storms. And we know that that's tied to climate change. In fact, empirically, for every degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, we warm the oceans. The strongest hurricanes get about 7% stronger in terms of wind speed. The wind speeds increase by about 7%. But the destructive potential of a storm actually goes as the cube, the third power of the wind speed. And so that means that we see a roughly 23% increase in destructive potential. That's a large enough signal that we can expect to see it with our own two eyes. We can see it playing out with these more destructive storms. And that's really the story when it comes to the hurricanes that we've seen in recent years.
Okay, in your piece in The Guardian, you say global warming made Dorian more intense. I usually hear that you can't really analyze if or how climate change impacted a specific storm until after it has passed. So why do you think we can confidently say climate change is playing a role in this storm?
Yeah, so there's a fallacy when it comes to attributing the role of climate change to sort of the intensity, for example, of these storms, that we need to use what's known as detection and attribution. There is a subset of the climate research community that prefers to use that tool. And the way it works is you can take a climate model, and you can run that climate model both with pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide and with the heightened levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we are now experiencing because of our fossil fuel burning. So in one case, without the human impact on climate, in the other case, with the human impact. And you see how often this sort of event happens in both cases. And if there's a large enough increase in the occurrence of that sort of event when you do many simulations of the modern climate, when you see a large increase in the number of those events in the modern climate relative to the pre-industrial climate, then based on those studies, you can detect and attribute the impact of climate change on the characteristics and the occurrence of that event. But that's one particular way of talking about the connections, and it has its own drawbacks and flaws. In fact, in our own published work, we have shown that there are some very important mechanisms that we know are playing out in the real world and are behind many of the most persistent weather extremes we've seen in recent summers. Wildfires, droughts, heat waves, floods. The climate models that are used in those attribution exercises don't actually capture some of the key processes. So by their nature, they are overly conservative. They're unable to capture some of the impacts that climate change is having on these storms, for example. And because of that, that means that these attribution studies tend to underestimate the linkage with climate change. But there are other approaches to talking about the connections. For example, James Elsner of Florida State University has published an article where he shows just empirically, based on actual observations, that there is this 7% increase in the maximum wind speeds of the strongest storms for each degree Celsius warming. So you can talk about that without having to run a climate model. You can talk about how the warming increased the intensity of the storm. You can talk about how the warming of the ocean surface led to more water vapor in the atmosphere. That's a simple physical relationship. It's an exponential relationship between sea surface temperatures and the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. We can talk about those connections in general without having to go into the specifics of a particular storm and without having to rely on the attribution exercises that are somewhat flawed in many cases because they're not capturing some key real-world processes.
Okay, and are waters in the Atlantic warmer than usual right now, and if so, by how much?
Yeah, well, first of all, we have to define usual because we sometimes fall into this trap where we'll look at a map, and the map will say it's depicting temperatures relative to normal, and it turns out that normal, for example, the way NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, defines normal is the average over a fairly recent period, 1981 to 2010. Well, that 30-year period has temperatures that were the better part of a degree Celsius warmer than pre-industrial times before we started increasing the concentrations of these greenhouse gases. So keep in mind that when we say normal, we mean normal for, say, the last 30 years, but the average over the last 30 years is already warmer by the better part of a degree Celsius, the better part of 2 degrees Fahrenheit from the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations since the pre-industrial, going back several centuries in time. So if you look at the sea surface temperatures where the storm, where Dorian tracked, if you look at the regions that it tracked, that its path took it through, those sea surface temperatures are between a half a degree Celsius and a degree Celsius warmer than the so-called normal. But the normal, the 1981 to 2010 average, is already about 0.7 degrees Celsius warmer than, say, a century ago. So what that means is that if you're asking the question, how warm are those sea surface temperatures in that region where the storm tracked relative to the pre-industrial period before we started warming the planet, then we're talking about, a degree and a half or even close to 2 degrees Celsius warmer than that pre-industrial baseline. And remember, for 1 degree Celsius, we already get a 23% increase in the destructive potential of those storms. So 2 degrees Celsius, well, now you're close to a 50% increase in the destructive potential of those storms. And again, that's a big enough signal that you don't just have to tease it out of the data. You can see it playing out on your television screens, in your newspaper headlines, in terms of the devastation, for example, that this particular storm did in the Bahamas.
That was climate scientist Michael Mann speaking with our own Brendan Rivers. In a moment, we're going to shift gears and talk about some other news and notes from the week, including an important event at Memorial Hospital aimed at addressing the opiate crisis. We'll be right back.
Hi there, it's me, Chris Thiele, host of Live From Here. Tune in for the launch of our season with guests Ezra Koenig of Vampire Weekend, Natalia Lafourcade, Matt Bronger, and Holly Laurent. Jake Gyllenhaal will also be there to share an excerpt from his recent Broadway play, Seawall, A Life. Our fall season is here, and it just won't be the same without you.
Saturday evening at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Listen to Pop-Up Country on 89.9 HD4 and explore country, folk, bluegrass, and blues by the musicians who created it as we get ready for Ken Burns' latest documentary, Country Music, coming to WJCT-TV in September.
Welcome back. Well, this Saturday, Memorial Hospital is hosting a drug take back day. They're calling it part of their overall commitment to crush the opioid crisis. Allison Mock, PharmD, is the emergency medicine pharmacist at Memorial Hospital in Jacksonville, and she joins us now. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me here this morning.
It's great to have you. And this is an interesting event that you're hosting both at Memorial's campus at University and Beach and also another location in Julington Creek, a drug take back day. How does this work? What's going to be happening?
So this is a great opportunity for members of the community to bring in any medications that you might have. It can be prescription, over-the-counter, expired, or even unused, tablets, liquids, anything like that. And if you bring any of those medications with you, it'll be a drive-through service, and local law enforcement will be there to collect the drugs, and they will dispose of them appropriately.
How do they dispose of the meds?
That's a good question. They take them. I don't know if they...
They destroy them
in a way that's more environmentally friendly than flushing them down the toilet or throwing them in the trash.
Which often is what people do
exactly.
With unused medication. Now, in particular, you are focusing on the opioid crisis.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
The opioid crisis is a huge thing that's going on right now in our country, and these drugs are being used inappropriately, so this event is a good way to get those drugs off the street and out of people's hands.
And so you're asking anyone who has access to a bottle of opioid pills or any other medication that they don't need anymore to bring it through the drive-through at Memorial, because this is just an easy way to remove the meds that could be abused. 6 million Americans, as Memorial Hospital points out, gain access to prescription medication through family members.
Exactly.
They can grab pills that aren't prescribed to them.
Exactly. And you just, they don't even realize necessarily what, you know, the implications are of taking these medications inappropriately. So say grandma passed away and she has a lot of leftover medications and you're like, oh, well, I don't know what to do with these things. Or, you know, and then people might use these medications to treat, you know, oh, I have a headache, and they take, oh, well, here, take this, and it's a tramadol, which is a controlled substance. It's a drug that's not being prescribed for you, so it's being used inappropriately, which could potentially lead down the road to an addiction.
Right. And the opiate crisis has been fueled so much by that, by people taking opiates for pain relief, legally prescribed. And because of their brain chemistry, they become addicted, and then they start seeking out the street illegal versions of the drug. Fentanyl in particular has been horrific and has caused so many overdose deaths in this community alone. The Jacksonville City Council is looking to sue the pharmaceutical giants over this crisis, and so have a lot of other cities.
That's an interesting point. The fentanyl that's on the street that is killing people in very small amounts is not the same fentanyl that's prescribed by your doctor. I mean, you can use a fentanyl patch, which is a synthetic opioid drug. And when used appropriately, there are side effects, obviously, mm-hmm. but it's a very good mechanism to treat pain.
And that's something that, as a health professional, I know you wanted to talk about, because people still do want access to this drug in controlled situations.
Exactly. Opioids work well to treat moderate to severe pain. If you have a major trauma or a major surgery, absolutely they are appropriate to use. You just have to be careful and know how to use the drug appropriately.
Now, what is the remedy for those that have gotten hooked on opioids or perhaps are being prescribed them inappropriately? There's something that I know you're familiar with at Memorial Hospital. It's called eForce. What is eForce?
So eForce is the Electronic Florida Online Reporting of Controlled Substance Evaluation Program. And it was a program, it's online, created by the state of Florida in 2009, and it's a way for prescribers and dispensers to see what has been given to the patient and what doctors are prescribing the drugs. So it before a program like this, it was hard for doctors to kind of see what patients were receiving, and it was hard for pharmacists to see how many times they've had a drug filled. So for instance, if a patient received a prescription for Dilaudid, which is an opioid pain medication, then they have it filled at the pharmacy, and say they come back into the ER and they say, oh, well, my prescription, like my opioid is, I need more. So it's a good way for the doctor to go in and be like, oh, well, you just had 20 tablets filled yesterday. Where did those tablets go?
Right. Because people would doctor shop.
They doctor shop, exactly. So it's very interesting when you have a patient and you can pull up that profile and see, oh, you can see, oh, well, they went to this doctor, this doctor, this doctor, and they've had their, you know, prescriptions filled at five different pharmacies. But before a program like this existed, you didn't know. There was no way to know.
Now it's easier for doctors to put up their hand and say, I'm sorry, but you just can't have any more of these pills.
Exactly. It gives the doctors a good reason to say, absolutely not. I don't feel comfortable giving you this medication, before where they didn't have any justification to say no. And then it caused patient dissatisfaction, which is obviously something you never want.
It's interesting to see how hospitals like Memorial are working in conjunction with law enforcement just the state's overall effort to crack down on this crisis, go after the pill mills that were notorious across Florida, for example, for years. There have been a lot of tentacles to this, and it's just been a horrific public health emergency. It continues to be. And so this is one small way that a hospital like yours can try to restore some balance.
Exactly. It is a huge public health concern, and there's not one particular group that I don't feel that is responsible for this whole crisis. It's a failure of the system. So this is a way that Memorial Hospital can kind of take steps to help remedy the situation, even if it's, you know, one Saturday. It's a way to get those drugs off the street.
Okay. With all of that said, tell us exactly how this is going to work on Saturday and how people can drop off their meds.
So it's going to be a drive-through situation, and local law enforcement will be there to take the drugs from you. You just bring them in, drive through, and we'll take them and dispose of them appropriately.
Couldn't be easier.
Nope. Don't even have to get out of your car.
Your guys are making it a one-stop shop. It's the Drug Take Back this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., Saturday, September 7th, at Memorial Hospital. That is at Beach and University. They're doing a satellite drug take back drive through event at the Memorial Julington Creek ER. A drive through, drop off your old or unused medications, let law enforcement handle it.
Yeah, our goal is to get 50 pounds of unused medication for 50 years anniversary of Memorial Hospital.
50 pounds for 50
That's
years.
That's right.
There you go. We had to get that in too. All right. Thank you so much. She's Allison Mock, PharmD, the emergency medicine pharmacist at Memorial Hospital. Again, that drug take-back event, it's a drive-through event this Saturday at Memorial, kicking off at 10 a.m. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, time to de-stress after the storm with a little fun. Keep listening for a live in-studio performance from Jonah Lumpkin. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter David Farenthold talks about following the money of Trump family businesses, including Trump hotels, and the ethical questions related to those businesses. Farenthold's reporting led Donald Trump to agree to shut down his foundation. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Marco Werman. Each day we cover the world beyond our borders and across our borders.
Homeland security, that's exactly what we want. There's no better term, there's no better name.
Just like an American, you can't stop an American from traveling abroad. Well, you can't stop a Guatemalan or a Honduran from leaving their country as well.
America's border, just one of the stories we follow on the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
The unemployment rate is low, real low. But that still doesn't mean everybody who wants a job has one.
I think there's a lot of vulnerability and shame in letting people know that you're having a hard time getting a job. It'd be a lot more satisfying to show up to a job and have colleagues that you're working with than it is to sit at home and apply for jobs.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, looking for work in the Lone Star State, next time on Marketplace.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
100 years ago, the United States welcomed its first Somali immigrants. That community has grown to well over 100,000. What matters most to them in the places they now call home?
We're not going anywhere. We are here. We are here to stay as Minnesotans.
We head across America to Minneapolis, where Somali Americans are speaking out. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Finally, this hour, every Thursday night at the Local in San Jose, fans turn out for Jonas Sofa Jazz Sessions. This is a great way to get out of the house if you've been cooped up for the storm. Get out and get back into normal life. John Lumpkin and band are here now with a preview. And guys, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing?
Good. How are you guys, band? How are you guys doing? They're waving at me. They're going to play in a minute. Okay, so they'll be performing tonight at the Local in San Jose, and this is a great new place, which has a great atmosphere, ambiance, and live music. Tell me what's happening tonight.
All right, so what's happening tonight is pretty much in Jacksonville, I invite out bassist Jonathan Batiste, who's the leader of the Urban Intellectuals and also Jacksonville University, and also UNF Jazz Ensemble saxophonist DeAndre Letsum to come out and play. And we host a jam session every Thursday, and we invite out young musicians from Douglas Anderson, also collegiate as well, UNF, Jacksonville University, Florida State College, and also experienced musicians as well, like, you know, John Ricci, Chris Creswell, David Champagne. And we just make it a family type of atmosphere to where we're just sharing the wonderful music of jazz.
And this is a way to really experience the incredible talent that we have here in our community.
Absolutely.
These musicians are the tops.
Yes, absolutely. They get calls out. I'm just thankful to be called their friend and also be able to share this wonderful music with everybody.
Are you going to be performing too?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the that's really the dynamic. Like, it's something that I always wanted to do, like even when I was in college, to create something for my city. So.
And this is every Thursday night, which means tonight is the night to go check out Jonas Sofa Jazz Sessions at the Local.
Mm-hmm.
They have these sofas there in the restaurant. So that's what this is a reference to. You can kind of even hang out on a couch while Absolutely. You have a drink and something to eat and hear some jazz. So what are we going to hear right now?
What you're going to hear right now is When the Saints Go Marching In, and that features Jonathan Batiste on upright bass and also Peter Goricki on upright bass, Patrick Campbell on trumpet, DeAndre Letsum on soprano saxophone, and Mr. Royce Turner on piano.
Here they are. Can't wait to hear it. Thank you. That is some hot jazz right there.
Oh, yeah.
Aren't they great?
Absolutely.
So man. Great. Absolutely. Thanks, guys. You can go see them tonight. It's the Jonah Sofa Jazz Sessions at the Local.
Yes.
Tonight at the Local restaurant and bar in San Jose. There's another corresponding session on the UNF campus.
Oh, yes. It's actually the UNF Alumni Association, headed by Jen Perkins, who's the president. She's going to be hosting their social there on tonight. They do it every third Thursday. So they're doing this Thursday at the Local. So it's definitely
it's all at the Local.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
All the jazz is at the Local. John Lumpkin, the second and band. You guys are so good. Have a great show tonight. Go out and see them. Get out and enjoy yourself after the storm has passed. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Melissa, for having me.
And that's our show. Tomorrow, a look back at the hurricane and the other stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us as we get back to regular routine. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.